5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester, as well as London on Valentine's Day, and then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com, and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.
Hello, you lovely listeners. This is what we've been up to on Patreon this month. We've got clips from Under the Duvet, which is the after show, in the news, and also our full bonus episode, which is available for $10 and up patrons. Also, this is a reminder to go and vote for us in the Listener's Choice at the British Podcast Awards, because once again, we have not been nominated in the true crime category. Anyway, have some Patreon stuff, and we'll see you soon.
Shall we kick off? We actually are starting in Birmingham today. Kind of Birmingham, kind of Gloucester. Gloucester is in the southwest of England. If it sounds familiar, it's because Gloucester is where, of course, the Wests were doing all their killing.
And where Dr. Foster went to.
And where Dr. Foster went to help everybody remember how to say Gloucester. But if you're thinking it's about the Fred West new discoveries, I'm not talking about that, actually. I just coincidentally happened to take us to Gloucester. So, Gloucester. Gloucester Dr. Foster. This is where the dismembered remains of a young woman were found this month, so May 2021, in a suitcase. And honestly, I have recently, as of like 2 weekends ago, started rewatching all of Criminal Minds from episode one. I'm not saying it's the perfect TV show. By far, it is not. Am I enjoying it? Yes, I am. This case feels like it's out of an episode of Criminal Minds. There are just scenes in Criminal Minds that I watch now, obviously with like having written the book, obviously having done true crime for 4 years. And I know that the people who work on Criminal Minds are like Jim Clemente, people who really know that field inside out. But they like so on it. And then like one point they'll say something like, oh my God, a psycho with a whistle. And I'm like, that person isn't displaying any of the signs of being a psychopath. You know that. You're using it completely incorrectly. And it feels so like jarring that you've just said that.
I also cannot with confidence say I've ever watched Criminal Minds.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be like, you're missing out, because I know you like to take a true crime break when we're not doing the show. I wouldn't be like, go watch it. I enjoy it.
Is it true or is it a drama?
It's a drama. So it's like a serial. So it's like 13 seasons out there, and each season has like 28 episodes in it. And it's just about like the behavioral analysis unit in the FBI and like them solving all these murders. It's good. They also just make like such assumptions in it, which obviously is to squeeze everything into like a 40-minute episode, but it's kind of enjoyable. Anyway, let's stop talking about Criminal Minds. They are not sponsoring this show. This particular case just kind of reminded me of what I'm currently doing with my life. So, back to Gloucester. Here we had 28-year-old Croydon-born Phoenix Netz. And Phoenix was studying in London before, of course, the global pandemic hit and all students' lives were just fucking destroyed. And Phoenix had actually been a really promising young student with dreams of becoming a paramedic. But for some reason that doesn't seem entirely clear, Phoenix ended up dropping out of university in February 2019. Soon after this, it seems that Phoenix turned to drugs and her life began to spiral. With little money and nowhere to go, Phoenix moved into a women's refuge in Birmingham. And it was here that she met another woman named Garissa Kunita Gordon. And Gordon, this woman that she meets in the women's refuge, was a Jamaican national. And her and Phoenix struck up a relationship really quickly. And soon, they were rarely seen without one another. And their blossoming relationship was only intensified by all of the lockdowns last year. So, of course, they're these two vulnerable women. They're in a women's refuge. Definitely, we know that Phoenix didn't have many other sort of social connections or support network outside of this. And yeah, I can totally understand why you're living with this person. You can't go anywhere else, do anything else. Their relationship is super intense, super quickly. And that is like a very key part of the story I'm about to tell you all. And it seems like it got so intense that Gordon actually started to develop a sexual attraction towards Phoenix. However, those feelings were unreciprocated from Phoenix. But it does seem that Gordon wasn't particularly undeterred by this because she would ask Phoenix to engage in sexual activities with her on a daily basis. Naturally, of course, this made Phoenix feel deeply uneasy about her newfound friend who isn't sort of respecting the fact that she isn't into her in that way. And Phoenix even sent messages to her friends, so we aren't assuming that this made her feel uncomfortable. We know that it did, because she was sending messages to people she knew back in London saying things like, there's a girl here who keeps asking me to be sexual, and I think I'm going to move back to London because it's scaring me. Lol. So, yeah, things are heading in a strange direction for Phoenix. And after nearly 2 whole months of demanding sex from Phoenix, it seems that Gordon started to get aggressive, sometimes even physical, whenever she was told no.
Bad news.
Extremely bad news. And just extremely, like, heartbreaking because obviously they're in a women's refuge. Phoenix is trapped there not just through, like, her financial situation at the time, but also due to lockdown. It wouldn't have been just easy for her to leave that refuge and move back to London as it may have been even possible for her to do in another set of circumstances. During lockdown, where was she supposed to go? So she really is trapped in this nightmare situation. And things got worse. And on April the 16th, Gordon's advances took an even darker turn. That night, Phoenix was in her room preparing to go to bed when there was a knock at the door. She answered and let Gordon in. The pair got into yet another fight when Gordon again began demanding sex from Phoenix. And at this point, Phoenix says that she's had enough and asks Gordon to leave. And at this point, Phoenix even got up and, like, went to open the door of her room to make it crystal clear that she wanted Gordon to leave. She's, like, trying to escort this woman out of her room. But Gordon wasn't going anywhere. When Phoenix's back was turned, Gordon got up from the edge of Phoenix's bed, pulled out a blunt 14-inch kitchen knife that she'd been hiding in her trousers. So she very much comes into that room with a plan of what's going to happen if she's refused sex. She's not just grabbed it as like an opportunistic weapon that just happens to be in the room. She's got it on her person when she comes into that room that day. Gordon at this point lunges at Phoenix with the knife, planting it deep into her friend's torso. Phoenix, of course, keeled over in pain, screaming, help me, before hitting the bedroom floor. But Gordon didn't stop. She threw herself at Phoenix, stabbing her once friend again and again and again while she writhed on the floor. It appears from the postmortem reports that Phoenix was stabbed at least 4 times, but that she did not die immediately from her injuries. Lying on the floor in agonizing pain, Phoenix pleaded with Gordon to call an ambulance. At this point, perhaps, you know, some of that red mist dissipates, because Gordon actually did grab Phoenix's phone and go to call 999. But she stopped. probably, I think it's safe to assume that she stopped because she realised that if she called an ambulance, she would definitely be going to jail for stabbing somebody multiple times. And by now, by the point that this is all happening, Phoenix was dipping in and out of consciousness, and blood was gushing from her wounds. And so Gordon, instead of calling for help, used her dying victim's phone to Google the following. She Google searches how to fix a punctured lung, internal bleeding, and can someone recover from getting stabbed?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty damning, really, isn't it? And also, no. You take them to hospital is the answer to all of those questions.
Yes. And also, your friend that you've just stabbed multiple times hasn't just got internal bleeding. They've got external bleeding. Like, why is that the thing that you're fucking concerned about? She's going to die. And what's even worse, I mean, as if this isn't all horrible enough, what's even worse is that she Googles, Gordon Googles those things between 1:04 p.m. and 3:07 p.m. So she is doing this over the course of 2 hours. She's Googling these things. I mean, that is absolutely horrendous because it is suspected that during the course of those 2 hours that Gordon was sat there Googling this stuff, that Phoenix was alive the entire time. She hadn't yet died. But that obviously wasn't going to last, considering she had sustained 4 stab wounds, because the following day, Gordon woke up to find Phoenix's pale corpse lying in an enormous pool of blood on the bedroom floor. Knowing now that she had no other options, well, other than to go to the police and admit to what she had done, which she obviously wasn't going to do, she decided that she was going to dispose of Phoenix's body. So Gordon gets her phone out again and heads back to the internet. She heads specifically this time to Gumtree to purchase a 45-pound circular saw. I know self-preservation makes people do a lot of things.
But Gumtree?
Just being able to go to sleep and then wake up and be like, oh, she's dead now. I'll go buy a circular saw off Gumtree.
But it's not even just buying. Like, Gumtree don't send shit to your house. You have to go and get it. Like, why are you not getting it off Amazon? It would be the same price. It would come straight to your house. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's a weird thing. I don't understand it.
I don't actually know. But that's what she decides to do. And once she gets her hands on this Gumtree circular saw, Gordon follows through with her plan. And she cuts Phoenix's body into chunks small enough to fit into suitcases. And Phoenix's partially clothed remains were divided into 6 pieces and split into 2 suitcases. And next, in a particularly cold and calculated move, apart from obviously everything she's done up to this point is, but this bit, it's just, you know, it's the pinnacle of showing that she is thinking very, very rationally and logically about what she is doing. This isn't like a crime of passion that she just lost total control. Because Gordon then took Phoenix's phone and pretended to be her for the next month, an entire month. She sent text messages, emails, and she even made voice calls and voice notes to send to Phoenix's friends and her family back in London. All the while, the suitcases with Phoenix's remains sat in her now unoccupied room at the Women's Refuge. Yes, Gordon didn't even take the suitcases and go and dispose of them. She just put Phoenix's remains into these suitcases and then left them in Phoenix's room in the Women's Refuge, just to rot there. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I have no words.
And then on the 12th of May, so like we said, almost an entire month after she had killed her, Gordon finally decided that she needed to get rid of the body. So she hired a taxi driver from Wolverhampton to take her and the suitcases to the Forest of Dean in Gloucester. Luckily, Gordon wasn't about to get away with it, though. And this next bit really is very surprising. This case is very new. Obviously, that's why we're talking about it on In the News. It's only just happened this month. So I don't know the full details of it, but apparently a very like eagle-eyed member of the public hero spotted what they described as a man and a woman driving erratically near the town of Culford, and they called the police. And of course, if you did guess that it was Gordon and the taxi driver, you would be right. Why are they driving erratically? This is a weird thing we'll come back to, but I found that, like, how erratically would a taxi driver have to be driving that a member of the public would call the police and be like, that seemed really suspicious?
And, like, why is a random taxi driver got enough skin in the game to be driving erratically? Like, why is he nervous? Does he know what's in there?
This is the thing. I don't know. We'll come back to that in a bit. But Gloucester Police, to their credit, followed up on this report of a taxi driver driving erratically, and they actually had the car followed quite quickly. And unbelievably, the police actually managed to find Gordon standing alone by the entrance of a quarry near the Forest of Dean late that night. And nearby where they found her, they also found two very large suitcases.
What is it with the suitcases in the Forest of Dean?
I don't know.
Like, come on. Have I zoomed through space and lost all understanding of time? Or did this happen in, like, February as well?
I feel like I cannot remember what case it was, but there was another case involving forests, involving the Forest of Dean specifically, and suitcases. I can't remember what it was.
I'm sure there was. And I'm sure it was this year or either the tail end of last year.
And it can't have been this case, and we're just covering it now because there's more information out, because this literally happened May 2021. So I don't know what case that was.
Maybe it's a copycat, but that's definitely happened recently.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what made Gordon want to go there. We know she's on Google all the time, so maybe she found out that the Forest of Dean and suitcases, you know, is the ultimate body disposal method. Who knows? But yeah, obviously when the police get there, they find Gordon, they find the suitcases. And, you know, we've seen some pretty horrendous things on police body cam footage, especially of late. This particular bit, also horrendous. So one of the police officers' body cam footage, when they arrive at the quarry and find the suitcases, has actually been released. You can go and find it if you want to. You can see in it that the other police officer who's there with the one whose body cam footage has been released is opening the suitcases. They open it up, take a look inside, and shout, "What the fuck?" Because it's just the half of a woman's body, basically, that's been chopped up and dumped in there.
Such professionalism from the police there.
Classic. I mean, I know they're only human, but also, like, are you that surprised that there was a dead body in there? Like, I feel like that's what you would have been expecting to find in there.
I mean, that's what I assume whenever I see an abandoned suitcase, no matter where it is.
Precisely. Or even just a bin bag.
Why am I the weird one in this situation?
I don't know. I guess, like, the only thing I could say is also the fact that the body parts were a month decomposed.
Right, yeah.
So if we go back to our little aftermath.com analysis that we did in the Max Spears episode, by a month, I'm guessing you're at the liquefy stage.
One would think, yeah.
It's not going to be ideal. But the body parts were, of course, examined and identified using DNA as belonging to that of Phoenix Netz. So both Gordon and the taxi driver who had erratically driven her there were placed under arrest. But following interrogation, the taxi driver was actually let go, which did seem odd to me because, like we said, the body's very decomposed at this point. Would there not have been a smell and a lot of, like, oozage and, like, leakage from these suitcases when they were trying to get it into the back of the taxi, and a strong smell? I don't know.
It would depend on the quality of the suitcase, first and foremost.
This is true.
It's a nice little hard shell number. You're probably okay. But Michael Alec, no problem getting a taxi driver to take a cardboard box with a body in it. I don't know.
This is also true. Maybe just in this economy as a taxi driver, you just can't afford to be like, look, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about what's in the suitcase. Maybe you're just like, hey, look, I need the fare. So let's just, don't tell me. I'm not going to ask you, don't tell me. But then it does, of course, bring into question why, like you said, Hannah, was this taxi driver driving so erratically that a random member of the public felt that they needed to call the police? That seems weird. But anyway, we don't know what the actual situation is with the taxi driver. We just know that they have been released by police. So Gordon, after the arrest and interrogation, kept very tight-lipped about what had happened for a very long time. But on the 21st of April, just 2 days before she was due to stand trial, at Bristol Crown Court, Gordon confessed to the murder and dismemberment of Phoenix. And on the 4th of May 2021, she was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 23 years. And at sentencing, Judge Mrs. Cutts said, quote, "You are of previous good character. There have been long periods in your life where you haven't been violent. I believe your personality disorder only had an effect to a negligible degree, and this is what makes you a very dangerous woman."
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast. Wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.
I have already talked to you about this, but I'm going to say it again. Podcast recommendation that I listened to yesterday, and it is, I should have written it down. What the fuck was it called? It was called, it's the Times podcast that's like stories of our times. And it's done by like these Times journalists. It's like, I've never actually listened to it before, but I listened to it yesterday because they did an episode. Their most recent episode is on the origins of COVID-19. And I have not really been following what anybody's been saying. After the whole wet market stuff came out, after we all kind of thought that was the cause of it in Wuhan, I just sort of assume that's the case, and then I haven't really kept up with anything that's been going on. I was shocked to discover that basically the whole thing of it coming from a wet market has basically now been debunked, and that's just not the case. China, like, that's not where it came from. That everybody's like, yeah, that's not where it started. It's got nothing to do with the fucking Wuhan wet market. Shocked I was. And maybe this is again.
So what is it?
So basically, and this is all like hot off the press. This is all like in the last couple of days, this has been sort of coming out. Is, yeah, like I said, COVID-19 starting in the Wuhan wet market, totally debunked. Chinese government have even said that's not what happened. That's not where it started.
Yeah, we can't really listen to anything they say, though.
No, we can't. But also scientists are like, that's not where it started. Apparently, when they tested a bunch of the animals that had like been kept there, not one single animal was found to have COVID-19, like to have the virus. It was just like found in the sewage systems around the wet market. And apparently, like more than half of the initial outbreak cases had nothing to do with the wet market. So obviously, people just thought they were like people who were infected by somebody who had gone to the market. But apparently, not at all. Interesting findings. So there are a lot of varying views, as this podcast talks about, from scientists all over the world about where they actually think it started. But these Times journalists have been doing some serious digging, and this is fascinating. Basically, in 2012, so yeah, fucking ages ago, in southwest China, in a place called Tonghua, six men were sent into a copper mine, an abandoned copper mine, to clear it out, like to make it fit for use again. And apparently in the time that this copper mine had been abandoned or disused, it had just become fully populated with bats. Like they've totally taken over. So these men, some of them were just in there for a couple of days clearing it out, but clearing out a lot of like bat shit and stuff. All six of them got sick. And all six of them ended up being hospitalised at varying points. In the hospital, the doctors are absolutely baffled by what's wrong with them. They've got coughing, they've got fever, they've got pneumonia. Testing them for any kind of random tropical illness they can think of, nothing. They're negative for everything. Three of the men out of the six die. Then, afterwards, after the other three men are out of hospital, another disease expert in China finds out about this mystery illness and obviously hears about the bats and is worried because he's like, it sounds like it could be a coronavirus. So he gets the doctors to test those three surviving men for coronavirus, for any coronavirus, and they're found to have coronavirus antibodies. They realise at this point that the disease that these men got in 2012 that had a 50% mortality rate out of the six men who got infected was a novel coronavirus. It was one that they had never, ever come across. So they give it a name, and the Chinese government do a complete media blackout on it. So it was never reported. Like, nobody knew about this happening. But several of the scientists who were working in that hospital wrote theses or wrote papers about it. Two of them even used them in their PhD reports. So this happens and nobody kind of talks about it ever again, which is really weird because apparently after SARS happened, China went into like full-on virology mode, and they started a CDC center in every single major Chinese city. They opened a bunch of labs to keep an eye on coronaviruses and doing a lot of testing and a lot of just preparation in case there was ever another attack like SARS, and SARS obviously being a coronavirus. So what they said is this sample from the mine got taken to the Wuhan lab and kept there. And the Chinese government, like, we didn't do anything with it. It just got taken there and it just got left there, which I feel like bullshit. You are in like ultra mode, like in full focus mode on new coronaviruses because that's what China's so scared of. They find one in a fucking mine. It kills 50% of the people that got sick from it. And then they're telling us that they did nothing with it, but just put it in this lab. Bullshit. Important to know though, it went to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And this is where the sample was kept. It is 1,000 miles away. Wuhan was 1,000 miles away from this mine, right? That's also an important part of the story that I discovered. And these scientists from Wuhan Institute of Virology started going to this mine. They went there at least 4 or 5 times. They say in full hazmat suit, everything like that, appropriately done, they claim, but they went there. And they actually discovered dozens of coronaviruses, but only this one was novel. Only this one wasn't known previously to science, or like ever have been seen in the human population. Again, they said they knew nothing about it. I call bullshit. And guess what? This sample from the lab mine has now been tested over 96% genetically similar to COVID-19. So it is the closest match in the world. This sample that came from a mine 1,000 miles away from Wuhan is the closest match in the world that we have to COVID-19. So there's a whole like debate apparently going on at the moment about whether it's actually the same. What's really interesting that in 2017 in Wuhan, they opened a biosafety level 4 lab, which is the only one of its kind, or was the first of its kind, at least at the time, in China. And these are like the highest level of biosecurity labs that you can have. They require a lot of training and a lot of like security measures to be in place. And apparently in this lab, guess what they were doing? They were experimenting on different types of coronaviruses to see how to make them infectious to humans. So like how that process would happen so that they said they could find cures for that. So like as a preventative thing, like have cures ready in case those ever did mutate to become infectious and therefore hit the population. So what some people suspect was happening is that they were playing about with, and by that I mean experimenting on, this lab sample, this sample from the mine, and that they actually created COVID-19 from that sample that came from the mine by experimenting to see how to make it infectious to other human beings.
To make it more infectious.
To make it more efficient.
And that's the 3% difference.
Yeah, exactly.
The fuck, man? Like, I'm not even remotely surprised.
No.
Like, I'm just...
No, I'm not surprised. I'm horrified, but I'm not surprised. So I was like, how fucking common is this that people are doing this kind of thing? Apparently, it's super common. And it's normal practice to play about with diseases like this in order to create cures and to study them in a controlled environment. generally speaking, the consensus around the world is that it's too controversial and it's too risky. So the US had actually banned this kind of thing. In the UK, scientists are like, this is too controversial, we don't do it. But China are definitely doing it. And they openly admit that they're doing it. The problem when this Biosafety 4 lab was created was that there would be a real issue with it being in China, because China is so secretive, and also because they don't like voices of dissent. So would anybody, A, be brave enough to say if anything went wrong? And B, if they did, would they just be put in a fucking prison and we would never find out about it anyway? So there was actually an international assessment done of this center in Wuhan in 2018. And concerns, serious concerns were raised that the training wasn't up to scratch and that the safety at this lab wasn't up to scratch. So basically, like, how rare is it that lab leaks happen? Apparently in the last 6 years, there have been about 500-ish lab leaks in the United States.
Okay, that's too many. Feels like one is too many.
Feels like one is far too many. But apparently it's not that unbelievable that this kind of thing would happen. And apparently in 2004 in China, in a lab like this, like, a bunch of scientists got infected with SARS. So, like, it happens. And here they're playing around with a novel one that they actually made to be more efficient at infecting humans. And then the theory is that one of them just got infected with it and then was patient zero. And so I don't believe that it was, like, the whole, like, them releasing it on purpose, because I'm like, literally, who does that benefit? I don't understand the conspiracy theory behind that. But it 100% seems like now that this was created in a lab and there was a lab leak. One of the scientists got infected, or a bunch of them got infected, and then they just went out into Wuhan and spread it. Because, like, isn't it a massive fucking coincidence that 1,000 miles away from where this original strain was found, or where this bat cave was found with all these coronaviruses, in Wuhan, the literal center, the literal epicenter of serious coronavirus research in China, just so happened to be where this new coronavirus erupted from? It's literally 300 meters away from that wet market. Like, I can't believe, like, people would be like, basically some people are like, maybe it did happen 1,000 miles away and then somebody moved a pangolin from there to the wet market and that's what happened. But I'm like, Occam's razor, like, why are you trying to create all of these other things? I mean, I know why they are, because they don't want it to have been a lab leak. But I'm like, what are the fucking chances that Wuhan is where this is being studied and Wuhan is the epicenter of the outbreak? Like, how does it make sense that it started anywhere else? And apparently the scientists in this podcast are saying one of the key reasons that this lab theory was dismissed for so long was because so many scientists didn't want to align themselves with Trump. Because if you remember, Trump was saying this from the start.
I was literally just going to say, I'm really upset that Trump was right.
A broken clock, right, being right twice and all that. But I think, like, on the left, I think we can't sort of, which is what I've seen people do, which is dismiss or pretend like this lab leak theory has been debunked because Trump was saying it, or because it aligns with, like, some right-wing conspiracy theories and stuff. Like I said, I don't think that anybody did this on purpose. I think it was an accident. And I think that Chinese government is responsible, because they absolutely covered it up, because they know where this came from. How is it going to happen in the one fucking city where you've got that sample? It doesn't make any sense. Like, it's too coincidental.
Oh, totally. Like, that's the thing that I, like, keep thinking about. I'm like, oh, so they knew the whole time. Yeah. They've known for the past 18 months, and they just successfully made us all think it was about eating a bat.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, It's pretty ingenious, really.
Oh, yeah, because now they're saying, okay, it didn't start in the wet market. But they're basically saying, like, somebody just got infected and went to the wet market. And, like, maybe, because their theory is, like, maybe somebody from that town where the mine was, like, moved a pangolin from there to Wuhan and put it in this wet market. But I'm like, what, 300 meters away from where there's a CDC center that is playing around and experimenting with that fucking lab sample? Like, it's so... If this was a true crime case, you would be like, the circumstantial evidence is strong enough that this person did it. And I feel like it's like mind-blowing, the idea that it came from somewhere else and it just so happened to be in the city where this lab was with this sample.
So our story starts today in the foothills of the Andes, in central Chile, where there sat a small community of German expats who have lived there
for the last 50 years. Today, this little colony is known as Villa Bavaria, but it was originally known as Colonia Dignidad, or the Dignity Colony. Dignitas has ruined that word for everyone, hasn't it? I mean, not that I'm like opposed to it, if you want to do it or whatever, like, you know, let's not get into that argument, but it just can't help thinking of that. Dignity.
No, to be honest, my mind didn't go immediately to Dignitas. I went to it sounding like it's like a virtue. So like the chastity colony, the honesty colony, like all
Yes. Yes. So for decades, the people of Colonia lived here entirely separately from the Chilean communities that surrounded them. The settlement stretched across 70 square miles of farmland and forest, nestled in a valley surrounded by snow-capped mountains. So very much a truly idyllic scene in the Andes.
Mm.
But the dream of utopia it was meant to be was never really realised. Instead, this little colony had turned out to be a complete fucking nightmare of a horror show. Now, you're probably wondering how and why on earth there's a village of Germans all the way in South America and how they got there. Well, the story of how Villa Bavaria came to be is a dark one, one that the people of the village would rather the world forgot.
It's a story of torture, abuse, slavery, murder, and of course, everyone's favourite, Nazis. Thankfully, the story of Colonia Dignidad won't be forgotten because there are numerous survivors alive this very day fighting to get justice for what they faced there. What took place in Colonia Dignidad has been described as a ritualized, organized, and perfected practice of child abuse. It was essentially a paedophile's paradise. It all started back in Germany in the late 50s, just after the Nazis were defeated in the Second World War, with a man called Paul Schaefer. Schaefer was born in 1921 near the Dutch border of Germany. He was quite a clumsy child, so clumsy, in fact, that one day he accidentally gouged his own eye out when trying to untie his shoes using a fork. I am famous for falling down the stairs, like famous for it. Even I would not be stupid enough to try and untie my shoelaces with a fork and get it so wrong I lose an eye.
No, I mean, you'd hope not. And for anybody who's feeling uncomfortable at the thought of me laughing at a small child gouging their eye out with a fork, he goes on to become quite an unappealing man. So let's just know that my feelings on this are very much after I have read this entire case and been through it. So you'll catch up with my feelings on this pretty swiftly.
When he grew up, instead of telling everyone the embarrassing shoelace story, he just said that he lost his eye in the war, which, you know, you would.
You would. Yeah, you would. Not I was twiddling about with my fucking shoelaces like a bit of spaghetti and I stabbed my own eye out.
Ironically, during the Nazi regime, his application to join the SS was turned down because of his missing eye. So instead, he served as a Nazi nurse in the German-occupied France. Soon realizing that nursing wasn't really for him, in 1959, Schaefer decided he would instead become a Baptist preacher.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because obviously the Nazis were very much about, like, I know they were all into, like, the old Norse religions and all of that kind of stuff, but they were very, like, atheistic, weren't they? They were, like, spiritualism, yes, Norses, yes,
sure.
Runes, yes, but Christianity, no?
I feel like there was a bit of Christianity, but never Baptists, ever.
No, can you imagine?
No Baptists, I don't think. Like, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to get pulled up on this, but it's Patreon, so it's okay. I believe in Germany, like, most common form of Christianity is, like, because Martin Luther was German, hey, it must be Protestantism.
Yeah.
So there'll be, like, a United Church of Germany, I would imagine.
When I think of Baptists, I think of America.
Lutherans, maybe.
Yes, I can imagine. So our man, Paul Schaefer, was actually inspired to become a Baptist by the teachings of an American fire and brimstone preacher named William M. Barnum, the same exact man who had actually influenced Jim Jones, or who I guess would go on to inspire Jim Jones.
This whole case is super Jim Jones.
Yes, so much so. So Jim Jones. Because, yeah, Schaefer and Jones just have so much in common. And just like his American counterpart, Schaefer spotted a gap in the German market and squeezed himself into it. Now, we are going to reference Jim Jones quite a bit during this episode because it's really, really hard not to. I think if we didn't talk about Jim Jones, it would sound like we've got no fucking idea about true crime or about the world of cults. And we do, so we're going to. But we talk at length about Jim Jones in our brand new book, on sale now, link in the episode description.
I think it might be my favourite chapter, you know.
It's a very good chapter. We've got a whole chapter on cults, people. We do a big old fucking deep dive into Jim Jones. So if that interests you, even in the slightest, go get your hands on that book so that you can read our thoughts on him, Flavor Aid, and of course, the promised utopia of Jonestown.
And his pet ape.
And his pet ape. What was his pet ape's name? Mr. Muggs.
Mr. Muggs, yeah.
Mr. Muggs.
The victim no one talks about.
Absolutely, but we do, because we are here to give voices to the voiceless, after all. So, what we need to know here in this particular episode is that just like Jones, who used things like the Great Depression and racial injustice in America as a way to win followers, Schaefer used the fall of the Nazi regime and the resulting moral disarray felt by many in its wake to manipulate the people. These people were desperate for guidance. And it was also kind of like a spiritual turning point in Germany. People were kind of ready to go back to Christianity or were yearning for that kind of spiritual connection again. And, of course, Schaefer recognized this and he was there to provide. And just like Jones, this tall, thin man with grey hair, a glass eye, and a dark and intimidating presence, who many people who met him described as having a glare that could paralyze you, managed to convince hundreds to pack up everything and leave Germany for a foreign land halfway across the world.
But to fully wrap our brain boxes around just how he managed that, we're going to have to start all the way back in 1959, which is that when my mum was born? I feel like it might have been. She was definitely the back end of the 50s. This is when Schaefer began his life as a preacher by setting up a children's home, ding, 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 and Baptist ministry in the small German city of Krefeld in North Rhine-Westphalia. I've definitely got that wrong. Following American preacher Branham's way around things, he followed it to the letter, and those letters were a strict adherence to the Bible, a woman's duty to obey her husband, and apocalyptic visions, all of the things you need to run a cult very slickly. You'll all be totally unsurprised to hear that Schaefer used his position and power as a preacher to sexually abuse the boys in his care. So two of the young boys that suffered this abuse, their mothers, went to the authorities and a warrant was issued for Schaefer's arrest. So he decided to flee Germany, but not before he managed to convince 300 of his followers to go with him. And almost so similar to Jim Jones, but also the exact opposite at the same time. He told these people that the Russians were on the verge of occupying Germany and that they had to leave to escape the horrors of communism.
And if you know the Jim Jones story, it's like Hannah said, it's the exact opposite. He's like, hey, we should all go be communists and they won't let us in America.
Yeah, Russia was the end game.
But it's interesting, isn't it, though? I guess it's because of the time periods they were practicing it. So this is going down in like the mid to early 60s when I guess communism is the fear at the top of everybody's mind. And then Jim Jones is going down much later where it's like you're starting to have more of that social and political unrest and people demanding equality and civil rights. And he's like, hey, the way to capitalize on this is to tell everybody we need communism. So it's interesting. They play fully on whatever the people at that time need to hear from them. And that's what we see.
Oh, yeah. They swing with the times for sure.
Mm-hmm. Very much. So by 1962, with the permission of the then Chilean president, Jorge Alessandri, I think that's how we're going to say his name, Schaefer and his flock created the Dignidad Beneficent Society, a charity on a farm in Parral, Chile, which was founded on Baptist and anti-communist principles. So if you guys enjoyed that and you want to hear a lot more of that kind of content, then just head on over to patreon.com/redhanded now to take a look for yourself and become a patron.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast. Wasn't once, it was last year. Called Wisecrack from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre
of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year. Top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime / comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.